Good afternoon, everyone. This is Michael McCurdy with TestyMom.com, and I have Karen Quinn, the Testy Mom, here with me as well. Hi, Karen.
Hi. How's everybody?
If you have any questions while we're giving the teleseminar, please feel free to chime in as we go over the questions. Karen and I have received several questions over the last week, and we'll be hitting those questions over the next probably 20 to 30 minutes. Karen, this first question is for you. Question from a parent comes in and says, what do I do if my child does not get a concept? Specifically, they're referring to the spatial matrices. So no matter how much I try to teach him, he just doesn't get those types of questions correct. So do you have any advice?
Got it. So this is the mom whose child really couldn't get matrices, right? That's the one we're talking about. Okay. All right. Well, let me say matrices is a hard concept, and it really requires thinking skills on the part of the child that need to be built up over time. And for those of you, if you can't remember what we're talking about with matrices, it's like a hand goes with a glove the way a hat goes with, or a head goes with a hat. So it's, you know, the thing, you look at the relationship between the two items on top and you figure out what that is. And then you have to identify what goes with the bottom picture in the same way. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about matrices. And for matrices, what you're going to have to do is there is a step before a child can really understand and do matrices that has to be mastered. And I know that many of you have seen these in workbooks, and you know, where you might see like three items in a row and the child has to match the things on the left side with what it goes with on the right side. So like a snowflake goes with a snowman, or, you know, a button goes with a jacket, something like that. And so, you know, you've seen these in many workbooks, and you're going to have to do those because you want to practice what goes together. And I want to make some suggestions. If you can certainly buy workbooks go to Barnes & Noble, go to bookstores and look for bookstores where they have questions about what belongs together. And when you do those questions with your child, ask them, why do they go together? So they start thinking about, why does snow go with a snowman? Why does a glove go with a hand? Because they're going to have to be able to make that their generalization in order to do a matrix question. And if you go to my other website, Testing for Kindergarten, and you go to the book section, there's something called my recommended products. And if you go to my recommended products, the second page, there are some workbooks that I recommend for doing matrices, for practicing matrices, some beginning workbooks, analogies for beginners, first-time analogies, lollipop logic. Those are all really good workbooks to get to start practicing what goes together. And that's the first step to doing analogies, and it's the first step to doing matrix questions. So I would start with those if you're having trouble teaching your child matrix questions.
Okay, great, great, great insights. And again, we've had a few callers join the call today. So if you have any questions, please feel free to chime in during pauses that we have. And we'll get to the next question here, Karen. The next question is, how can I find out what IQ test, or I guess probably gifted and talented test, they use in my public school system? Is this usually information readily available, and this person is writing in from New Jersey?
The thing to do for that is, first I would start just by going to your school district's website. They often have a gifted and talented section, and often there's information there about what they use. You know, what are the qualifications for a gifted program, you know, what tests they might be given, or what year the gifted and talented program even starts. It doesn't always start in kindergarten. Sometimes it starts in first or second grade. So beyond gift testing information, they also have information about how the child performs in the classroom. So you want to go to your website, see what you can find out there. If you can't find it at the website, I would just say call the school and ask, is there a gifted program in my district? And if so, how do I find out more about it? And let them tell you how to find out more about it, or if there's someone you can talk to about, you know, what the qualifications are. And if you can also ask them, what is the test? And you want to ask, when you ask about the test, make sure you write down specifically what it is. Often it's just a bunch of initials, so you want to write down those initials so that you can do some research on the test itself and make sure that, you get the initials down and get it right so you can identify and research the test. Okay?
Okay, great. The next question here is along the lines of test endurance, and we talk a lot about this with parents. I've had several conversations, but I'll let you field this one, Karen. The question is, I've worked a lot with my 4.5-year-old following your guidelines. She took the Stanford BNA and was out of there in 30 minutes. Then she did the same with the ERB, 30 minutes. ERB is the same as the LIPSI test. Disappointing results. She is very bright, just doesn't seem to want to keep at it. Do you have any advice for stretching the kid's drive to sit and continue on?
Okay, there's actually, I see two parts to this question, and the first part is about the fact that a parent works with a child and does everything they can to make sure they're ready for testing. The child goes in and then doesn't do well, and I think we should just start with that, that issue, because I think it's something just for all of us to realize that in terms of test preparation, all you as a parent can do is expose your child to the kinds of questions they're going to have to answer in a test, make sure they do know how to answer them in the right way, practice with them in a fun way so they're interested, you know, in doing them. But at the end of the day, you have to remember that what we're talking about here are 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds. And you are not going to be able to control what happens with your 4 or 5-year-old in the room. You know, they might be in a bad mood. They might not like the tester. There's just so many reasons that, you know, things that can affect a child's score. So, I think that it's really, really important to realize that there's only so much you can control. You have to do your part, which is making sure they've been exposed to the concepts and working with them on being able to sit still for a period of time and focus. I mean, that's important as well. But then at the end of the day, it's going to be up to the child to go in the room and perform and do what they know how to do. And so if it happens that you've done everything and your child goes in and doesn't test well, you know, you can't beat yourself up because, you know, it is what it is. And your child and you just take it from there. And the important thing is that you want to find the best school situation, the best fit for your child. And so that's just something to keep in mind. Now, you know, in terms of testing, you know, there's really two sides to it. There's your child has to have the abilities that are being evaluated. They have to know the content, you know, of what they're going to be asked. But there's another side to it, and that's kind of a behavioral side. And that is that kids need to focus and pay attention and listen and not, you know, want to be showing off or playing or doing things they're not supposed to be doing while they're testing. And so for kids who have trouble focusing and attending, that doesn't mean they're not smart. It's just focusing and attending is really an ability a child needs to master before they go to school. So one of the things I would say is to start working with your child on things that she enjoys doing and work with her on focusing and paying attention. So if what she really loves to do is to play a game or to read to her or to do an art project, whatever she likes to do, let her work with her on doing that project and kind of get a read on how long she can focus without, you know, losing attention. And then the next week, what you might want to do or a couple of days later is try this or a different activity with her and try to stretch it out for 5 more minutes. And then do it again and try to stretch it out for 10 minutes. And then you might even show her on a clock, you know, we're going to work on this art project. You see how, you know, it's now 5 o'clock. When the big hand goes to the 6, when it's 5:30, that's when we're going to stop. So let's see if we can really work hard on this for 30 minutes. And you want to reward her and praise her for working hard at things for longer periods of time. and always tell her how much you appreciate how hard she tries and how well she pays attention. And once she sees that she can be successful focusing on things that she likes, then, you know, you want to try something she doesn't like quite as much. Maybe puzzles, if that isn't her favorite thing, and really, but make it a puzzle she, you know, likes to do, like with some of her favorite characters. But you just want to work on that skill of focusing and attending to something for longer and longer periods of time, because for the test, she's certainly going to have to focus for up to an hour. And in school, focusing and attending on things that aren't your favorite things is something that every child is going to have to do. So it's something you want to practice. And certainly it takes building up this skill over time. It's not something they're just going to, most kids are going to be able to jump in and do right away. So that's a skill you want to work on.
Great. Great insights there, Karen. Thank you. Mm-hmm. The next question here is a question, actually, someone who read your book, Karen, Testing for Kindergarten. The question is, I also had been meaning to ask you a question that occurred to me while I was reading your book, and she's referring to Testing for Kindergarten. So much of what you wrote resonated with me, except for one thing. It seemed like the whole process of working with the child in the way that you did, i.e. snuggling up together to do an activity after work, et cetera, lends itself to the family with only one child, even though I know you have two. What about the kid who has a little sibling that takes up so much of mom's time when they get home at night? Everything you described would be within our reach for the fact that we have a 1.5-year-old who wants to be involved in everything. What advice do you have to work with your child when there's another vying for attention?
Yeah, that's hard. I think that's really hard. And you know, when I worked with my son, I had two kids at the time. So although the second child was older, not younger, so that made it a little bit easier. But one of the things I would say is in the book Testing for Kindergarten, in terms of all the games and activities I suggest, a lot of the games especially can be played with more than one child. But to do that, you might have to kind of adjust the rules and the questions a little bit for the younger child. You might have to ask the younger child a much simpler question if you're playing some kind of word game or something. And you can ask a harder question to the older child and make it a little competition. And maybe you can get the little one to pay attention and everything. Now, if you do have, let's say, a young one, like a 1.5-year-old who wants to be in the middle of everything, one of the things you can do is put out a little project for your older one where you can be right there and you can be nearby, like maybe a craft project or a stringing beads or practicing drawing letters or something. And you're right there and you're near this child, but you're also paying attention to the second child at the same time. So you might try something like that. I also recommend trying to carve out like a 30-minute window every day if you can, but if not every day, maybe 5 days a week, where you can have one-on-one time with the older child who needs the special attention. And whether you do this using your sitter or your husband or a grandparent, or maybe another parent comes over with their little one-year-old and watches them for half an hour, find a way to get some one-on-one time. Maybe you put the little one to bed first and then you spend a little time with the older one. That is what, when I was working with my own son, Sam, when he needed special attention, luckily we had a sitter and she would pay attention to Skylar, my daughter, and I would focus on Sam. And it's always harder with multiple children. And in fact, if you go to where I sell my game on Testing for Kindergarten and you look at the videos of the children and the families playing the games, in both cases, there's a little child there who's not really paying as much attention, but the parent is trying to focus on the older kids. So, you know, you manage the small ones while you're working with the older kids. And it's not easy, but it's certainly something that can be done. And you just have to do it with you know, when you have more than one child. And so those might be some hints of ways to do it, you know. And at the same time, the other thing, the opposite, when I talked about, you know, focusing on the older child with a project and then working with the little one, you can also try to give the little one something they're really interested in, even if it's a video for 30 minutes. It's you know, or maybe if she likes to, you know, play with, scribble with colors or play with blocks, whatever you can get her to do for 30 minutes or 20 minutes, and you can kind of keep checking on her and then also check with the older child. Poor teachers, when you think about it, they've got like 20 kids in a classroom and they've got to try to pay attention to everyone. So it's rough, but you can do it.
Let's see the next question here, and I can answer this one as well, and you can chime in as well.
Uh-huh.
The next one is, when the test proctor asks the question, what is the best concept to get the child to retain the question? Our kids are trying to remember the entire question instead of focusing on important parts of the question. So how should a child decipher the pertinent parts of the question? I mean, I think, you know, it's a question of just really, you know, as you're practicing with your child on the question, to really have your child repeat the question, ask your child, okay, so what are we looking for in this question actually before they respond? How did you interpret this question? And then, you know, if they're asking something, well, if Susie has more pieces of candy, you know, three pieces more than Johnny, you know, candy, how many more does Susie have? You know, and then ask it in the opposite context, you know, Susie has three less. So kind of, you know, use the words in a different way and rephrase the question in a different way just to make sure your child's listening, and only change one of the words within the sentence. So smaller to larger, larger to smaller, you know, hot to cold, cold to hot. So you interchange the keywords within the question so your child can really see the differences of what they're actually looking for in the question. And the main thing is, you know, as you're practicing with your child on these tests, even if your child answers the question correctly, you really need to make sure that you're asking your child why they answered the way they did. And if they answer incorrectly, ask your child why they answered the way they did. And as you go through each of the answers, so you have a question and there's four answers and they pick number one and, you know, that's the incorrect answer. You ask the child right then and there, why did you pick number one? Well, let's talk about it. And then you go right down the line. Well, is it number two? Let's think about it. You know, what are the key words in the sentence that would make this one right or make this one wrong? And then go through each of the answers individually so the child can identify why each of the incorrect answers is incorrect and why the correct one is correct. And it's really just getting your child attuned to the test. Neither, either, or. Hotter, colder, a lot of opposites, a lot of larger than, less. So once your child kind of gets the cues on how there are certain keywords or phrases that most of these tests use throughout. Karen, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that was actually a good answer. You know, I think those are all good suggestions.
Okay, the next one here, it says, not sure if I can attend and not sure if this has been covered already, but wondering if the kid can get in trouble for saying that he practiced test questions at home. My son loves doing test questions and refers to them as test questions. Should we start calling them something else?
Yes.
I would probably say yes. I mean, the DOE outlines, you know, in their, if you're referring to like the OLSAT for the New York City Gifted and Talented, most tests, you know, any type of public school that your child may be attending is going to outline, you know, the consequences if the proctor knows that the child has been prepped in any way. So I would probably say, yes, I wouldn't use the phrase test questions. I would use, you know, play questions. You might probably
workbook
steer away from workbook questions or homework. Homework is usually a good one. Or just, you know, reading time, you know, time to read, so they can correlate that with reading, or puzzle time if you're using some sort of puzzles and manipulatives that are used on like the ERB and WIPC. I would steer away from the word test for sure. And Karen, did you have any insights on that?
No, I think just giving it another name is fine. And, you know, I remember my kids when my daughter was getting homework and my son wasn't, and I was working with him, I would call it homework, and he loved getting to do homework because his big sister got to do homework. So at that time, he was excited about it. Not anymore, but so homework for kids who have older siblings might be a good one because, you know, it's like you get to do homework like your brother does, and you know, they love getting to do what their older brother and sister get to do. So that can be a good one, especially if there's an older sibling. But definitely I wouldn't call it test questions. I would definitely not call it that. Call it something else. And give it a name and get them used to calling it that. So if he refers to it, it's not test questions.
Yeah, and also something to keep in mind with these, you know, test preparation per se. It's like, this is more school preparation. All the concepts that are on these tests really prepare your child for school.
Right.
And these are questions that you should be working with your child regardless if they're actually going to be taking these tests or not. These are concepts that you should be incorporating in your daily life, preparing them for first, third grade, and of course, kindergarten. So Karen, I don't know if you have anything to add on, you know, the whole, you know, people get really into like the test preparation piece, but do you want to kind of elaborate on, you know, that?
No, I think that's a great point to remember that, you know, if you're doing quote unquote test prep, what you are, you know, doing the kinds of questions and teaching your child the kinds of concepts that a child needs to know once they start school. And you want your child to start school ready. You want your child to start school having mastered the kinds of concepts that are on these tests, because they wouldn't be on these tests if they weren't concepts children need to do well in school. So, you know, we all want our kids to start school just ready to hit the ground running. And, you know, whether you call it test prep or school prep, you know, you want to make this fun as you can. You don't want to make it hard and like, you know, painful for your child. You want to make it fun, but, it's all the stuff you're doing for test prep is getting them ready for school. And don't forget that because it's so important.
Okay. Excellent. The next question here, this is a New York City specific question on the OLSAT test. The question is, what languages does the New York City Department of Education give the OLSAT test in? Currently, the OLSAT test is given in 11 different languages here in New York City. And when you register to take the OLSAT test, you will have to indicate if you want it in another language other than English. Currently, the languages that the OLSAT test is administered in New York City, English, of course, I believe it's Arabic, Bengali, Chinese, which includes Cantonese and Mandarin, Haitian Creole, Korean, Russian, Spanish, and Urdu. So those are all the languages. I get several questions. Japanese is not covered in that. I get several questions from Japanese parents asking, you know, if the test is covered in Japanese. And I also heard from someone, I believe, who asked if it was in Polish. Unfortunately, no. So currently, those are the only languages, and it does not include Japanese or Polish. Let's see the next question here, and we'll just go to this last one here. The next question is, this is a long question, so bear with me. Last year, my daughter was round two Hunter, which Hunter is a school here in New York City, which is you test into and you take the Stanford-Binet, and they have two rounds of interviews. The first, the fun is to take the Stanford-Binet test. And if you score at a high enough score, anywhere from a 142 to a 148, which has been historical, or above, you will get asked for a second round at Hunter, which is more of a group setting. So for those who aren't familiar with that, that's a quick synopsis of what Hunter is and what this this person is referring to. So last year, my daughter was round two Hunter and had a top OLSAT score, but didn't get into Hunter and didn't get a lottery seat at Nest or Anderson. And Nest and Anderson are citywide programs here in New York City, for those who aren't familiar with those, for gifted and talented. We decided not to do any of the district schools, as she is very young for the grade and like the community feeling and quality of our local PS234 in Tribeca. PS234, for those who aren't familiar, is a public school here in New York City, Manhattan, in the Tribeca area of downtown. And it's a very good general ed public school. Still, we'll have her tested again to see if we can get any lottery seats at citywide schools. Do you know if the OLSAT is any different for first grade entry than it is for into kindergarten? I can't seem to find this information anywhere and figured you may know. Also, well, let me answer that question first. Then she has another question. The test going into first grade is the same exact test as it is going into kindergarten, with the exception there will be 20 more questions on the OLSAT portion of the test. So going into kindergarten, it's a total of 128 questions, 40 of which are the OLSAT, 88 are the Bracken. Going into first grade, it's 148 questions, 88 are the Bracken, which is the same exact Bracken, 60 of which are the OLSAT. The first 40 will be the same exact questions that the going into kindergarten take, and then there'll be additional 20 questions. They're not the same they're just additional questions for each of those sections within the OLSAT test. So it is the same exact test, OLSAT level A, that your child will be taking. You have to take into consideration, usually OLSAT was designed for kindergartners going into first grade. So what the DOE actually did was scale it back to so the pre-K could actually take it and going into kindergarten. So the OLSAT test is actually designed for kindergarten students, not pre-K students. So the DOE, it's my understanding, just took 20 questions out so the child could sit through the whole test. So it is the same exact test. And let's see, her next part of the question here is, also with a late November birthday, do you know the groupings work for scores? Let's see. Are all the October, December birthdays grouped together regardless of when someone is tested within the few-week period? Better to have a later testing day or one's age grouping based on age when the test is administered? For the latter, do you know that the age ranges? So, yeah, you will be grouped on when the actual test is administered. So, I mean, people, depending on the day, there are technically advantages of when, you know, pushing it out as farther as you can, depending on how the groupings go. So if the way the scores are, there's no way to really, I mean, there is a slight advantage of trying to postpone the days, et cetera, especially if you're going to be taking other tests besides the OLSAT, like the Stanford Binet and the WPSC. But overall, I mean, the advantage, it really depends on the scoring and how they're actually grouped. So your child will be compared to October to December birthdays. So it's not necessarily the day they were born. It's within that grouping. So it looks like she's right in the middle of November. So there's not necessarily an advantage or disadvantage because she'll be compared to October or December. Unless you want to take into consideration, she'll be compared to someone born October 1st versus if she was born November 29th, as an example. So there's a 60-day window there. Opportunity. And for the range, for the latter, do you know the ranges? It is just by what you indicated here in the question. So it's for every quarter. So January, February, March are grouped together. April, May, June are grouped together. July, August, September are grouped. And then October, November, December are grouped. Now keep in mind, the later your child's birthday is, the more questions they can miss. So it's, you know, if you're at a later birthday, you can actually miss more questions on the OLSAT, still score at the top level. So it really depends on the birthday, et cetera. So, I mean, as far as advantages, disadvantages, I've heard it's like it's better to be kind of in the middle versus in the middle or late versus like having a January birthday. It's just, I mean, I'm not sure if there's really statistically significant levels. I mean, there might be some advantage depending on the exact day you take the test. I always tell parents to push it out as far as possible, just so you're more comfortable with the setting to make sure your child is fully prepared as they walk into the test. Karen, did you have any?
Yes, pardon? I was asking questions.
I just wanted to ask a clarifying question about that. When you say like the later your child's birthday is, the more questions they can miss. Do you mean the later mm-hmm. within that grouping or the later within the like a later group or later within the, say, October to December grouping? So my child's birthday is...
I'm sorry, you cut out through part of that question. I apologize.
Sorry. So if you look at children within the October to December grouping,
mm-hmm.
If a child is born later in that grouping, they can miss more questions? Or do you mean the later groups can miss more questions than the earlier groups?
Correct. It's the later groups. So the October through December group can miss more questions than the January through March group. It's not within the group. It's not within the October through December group.
Yeah, okay.
Younger kids can miss more questions.
Yeah, younger kids, but it's not October 1st through the October 1st birthday, you know, is in the same, you know, it's in the same realm as the
right.
December 31st birthday.
Right.
It's not a sliding scale at that point. They're just grouped all together within the quarter. Which, you know, it's not the best system, but at least they do divide it up. I mean, it's better than, you know, the alternative of a January birthday being compared to a December birthday, as an example. And that's all the questions we have today.
Michael, I just want to throw one more in there that we had that we didn't get to. And then if anyone else has a question, I just want to do this real quickly because since I did a video that relates to it, I just wanted to say something about it. which is we got a note from somebody who said that they're enrolling their child to take the OLSAT for the first time. And she says, I was wondering if you knew any programs or have any practice tests for my child. She's a low-earning mom, and she found one place who wants to charge almost $1,000 for a two-month program. Is this normal? I'm not really sure how it works. Can you give me some more information? And what I wanted to say is about that is the you know, these tutoring programs can be very expensive, and I just did a video that you can access on testingmom.com where I compared all of the OLSAT practice workbooks and materials that are out there. And they range in price from, you know, $50 to maybe $300. And I sort of went through what are the advantages and disadvantages of each of the different test prep materials that are out there. So I wanted to point that out to you. There's also, I think, I also have some reviews of the Bracken materials. So if you want to get some more materials beyond what you're getting on testingmom.com, there are materials out there. And I just wanted to point that out. Michael, where are the materials? Do you want to say on the website?
Yeah, it's under the Parents Resources section. So if you go to Parents Resource and then just scroll down near second from the bottom, you can get all the information there. That Karen just did a great job videotaping all the tests that's currently available for the OLSAT and Bracken.
Right. Really, you don't have to go for tutoring. I mean, if you can do a lot of this slowly at home on weekends and you know, just remember to try to keep it as fun as you can and for your child so that, you know, they don't feel like you're working them and making them do something very unpleasant, because you don't want them to identify the test as being a very unpleasant experience because we do this boring stuff at home. So try to keep it fun, and you can do some of that, more of that test prep at home too. So I just wanted to say that one, Michael, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Anything else as before we...
Anybody else have any questions before we go? Everyone's so quiet today. Okay.
Yeah. Does anyone else have any questions before we go? We're getting ready to close this teleseminar.
I had a question about, you were talking about bilingual kids, or actually kids testing in a second language. What about bilingual children who would be testing in English, but they might be accessing other languages?
Which test are you talking about that will they be taking?
To be honest with you, I'm not sure yet.
Okay. Well, I just want to say something about if they're testing with a psychologist,
mm-hmm.
If they're testing with the ERB for a private school, let me start with that. You want to make sure you tell the tester that this child is bilingual, because if they don't test quite as well in the language and verbal areas, the schools will take that into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
With the Stanford-Binet test, if you tell the tester, it doesn't really matter because they're not going to take that into consideration, but the private schools will. What about, Michael, what about the OLSAT and the, you know, the public schools for gifted programs?
Yeah, on the OLSAT, it just, is the child already in a school setting, like a pre-K setting, or?
No, she's really young. She's only two.
Oh, she's really young. I mean, usually what I tell parents is if they're in some sort of pre-K setting and they're, you know, speak English in a pre-K setting, you know, really, you know, if they're in some sort of learning environment and the predominant language is English that they speak, you know, to request the test in English, just because it's more of a school setting, especially with the OLSAT, it's definitely, when you're dealing with like the Stanford-Binet or the WPSI-ERB, it's a one-on-one with a child psychologist. The child usually doesn't know they're being tested. So it's very informal, very friendly, more of a playtime. With the OLSAT, it's more probably of a school-type atmosphere because the child is presented with questions on a piece of paper and they have to point. So you really want to – I would suggest whatever language is the predominant language in a learning environment for the child. So if the child is read to mostly, I would suggest English. And then also, once you determine the testing date for the child, suppose the test date is in February as an example for the OLSAT, you know, once that test date is determined – I would highly recommend just speaking and doing any type of learning activities in that language while assuming it's English. So if you select English as that language to take the test in, just start working in English only from that point forward. That way, when the child goes in, you've had a couple of months of English only in a learning environment and speaking environment as well. That's usually what we recommend to parents. It's like, as soon as you find out you're going to be taking this test, you have a couple of months, 2 to 3 months prior to the actual test and being administered. So during that 2 to 3 month period, it's a great time to really just focus on the language or speak the language and read in the language that the child will be tested in.
Thank you. Can I ask one other question? I don't know if you need to go.
No, go ahead.
Oh, no, yeah, of course.
Why not? What I know, I mean, I've done a little bit of reading about Hunter, and I just was wondering, what is it exactly that they're looking for in the second round?
Second round, I can answer that, and Karen can chime in as well. Usually, I mean, there's no, like, formula per se. I mean, there are definitely
right.
rumors out there of what they're looking for. So, this is all kind of like second information. So, take that into consideration.
Yeah.
Because I'm not an insider when it comes to Hunter at all. So, from what I've heard from parents and other sources available to me is Hunter really looks at a group setting, really looks at the personality type of the child, really looks at the interaction the child has with the instructors who are in the play area, in the classroom setting, really looks at how the child interacts with other kids as well. So one thing, to take into consideration, they really, I think a lot of it may have to do with like, okay, are there going to be any behavioral issues or, things like that to really look at, like red flag issues. And then it's my understanding that they look for, certain personality types per se. I don't know what those personality types are. Someone who may be more extroverted, introverted, more creative or music talent versus analytical type. So I think it's, there's no formula. I think there are a variety of children to come into the program because it is a research school. So I wouldn't suspect that they're looking for the same exact type of kid and, same type personality or same type of abilities and talents in each child. My guess would be that they would be looking for a variety of different types of gifts and talents that these children have going into the program would be my guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they do more test-like activities, when they have the kids there together, so they are kind of assessing them even further beyond the Sanford-Binet. But I think that probably changes from year to year. But certainly, all the things Michael said is true. So they're putting a class together, and that's very important for them. And it's going to be a diverse class.
Yeah.
So
it's a research.
Other question.
All right.
I sent these in. I don't know if you got them, but I sent two of them in anyway.
Yeah,
but,
we didn't get. I don't know if we got them because we didn't answer them. So maybe we didn't get them. Go ahead.
My daughter's birthday is December 28th, and we would really like to send her to a public school in New York, a gifted and talented, a really good public school in New York. And I'm just wondering, and because the cutoff in New York is December 31st, it's, I guess, my question is, first of all, is there any flexibility in, for example, if you look on the Hunter website, if you're applying to Hunter, they say you must be born within X calendar year. So is there any flexibility at these schools in terms of when you actually decide to matriculate your child?
No, in New York schools, which are gifted and talented as part of the public school system,
there's no flexibility.
There's absolutely no flexibility. So it's something to take into consideration, when you go to these programs. So your daughter will be in a class with, January birthdays through December birthdays.
Right.
Okay.
So it's one thing to
really consider as you make the decision. And if she's in like a private pre-K as an example, you're going to hold her back another year. Even if you hold her back another year for another year of pre-K,
right?
City Department of Ed will force you to go into the first grade.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they're very, very strict about it.
Okay.
So you'll have to just assess when the time comes, do you feel like she's ready. And she might very well be. I remember my daughter, her very best friend had a birthday that was like late December, same thing. And my daughter was like one of the younger kids in her class. She went to private school and her friend went to public school and she did great. I mean, she did just wonderful. So you just have to really look at your child and say, you know, is she ready? And right. Can she hold her own as the youngest kid in the class? And she might be just fine.
Okay.
So you'll check when the time comes.
And also you have to take into consideration, there'll be other, you know, October, November, December birthdays in her class as well. So she won't be, you know, necessarily an outlier.
Right.
You know, there will be other children, you know, within a 2 or 3 month range of her birthday as well.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any more questions from people calling in? All right. I think that's it. And we appreciate everyone calling in today. And we will be sending a link out with this tele-seminar today, and we'll also be posting it on PetSeaMom.com in the next couple of days. So thanks, everyone, for attending, and next week we will have another tele-seminar. We're finalizing the time. We will send that out, and it's going to be a Thanksgiving special tele-seminar, we believe. So we hope. So have a great day, and we will chat soon.
See you soon.